National Socialism. A sickly, bespectacled man, lacking a formal education, with an independent but narrow and confused mind, a poor writer and a worse speaker, Drexler was then employed in the Munich railroad shops. On March 7, 1918, he had set up a committee of independent workmen to combat the Marxism of the free trade unions and to agitate for a just peace for Germany. Actually, it was a branch of a larger movement established in North Germany as the Association for the Promotion of Peace on Working Class Lines. The country was then, and would continue to be until 1933, full of countless pressure groups with highfalutin titles. Drexler never recruited more than 40 members, and in January 1919 he merged his committee with a similar group, the Political Workers' Circle, led by a newspaper reporter, one Karl Harrer. The new organization, which numbered less than 100, was called the German Workers' Party, and Harrer was its first chairman. Hitler, who has little to say in Mein Kampf of some of his early comrades, whose names are now forgotten, pays Harrer the tribute of being honest, and certainly widely educated, but regrets that he lacked the oratorical gift. Perhaps Harrer's chief claim to fleeting fame is that he stubbornly maintained that Hitler was a poor speaker, a judgment which riled the Nazi leader ever after, as he makes plain in his autobiography. At any rate, Drexler seems to have been the chief driving force in this small, unknown German workers' party. The next morning, Hitler turned to a perusal of the booklet which Drexler had thrust into his hands. He describes the scene at length in Mein Kampf. It was 5 a.m. Hitler had awakened and, as he says was his custom, was reclining on his cot in the barracks of the 2nd Infantry Regiment, watching the mice nibble at the breadcrumbs which he invariably scattered on the floor the night before. "I had known so much poverty in my life," he muses, "that I was well able to imagine the hunger and hence also the pleasure of the little creatures." He remembered the little pamphlet and began to read it. It was entitled My Political Awakening. To Hitler's surprise, it reflected a good many ideas which he himself had acquired over the years. Drexler's principal aim was to build a political party which would be based on the masses of the working class, but which, unlike the Social Democrats, would be strongly nationalist. Drexler had been a member of the Patriotic Fatherland Front, but had soon become disillusioned with its middle-class spirit, which seemed to have no contact at all with the masses. In Vienna, as we have seen, Hitler had learned to scorn the bourgeoisie for the same reason, its utter lack of concern with the working-class families and their social problems. Drexler's ideas, then, definitely interested him. Later that day, Hitler was astonished to receive a postcard saying that he had been accepted in the German Workers' Party. "I didn't know whether to be angry or to laugh," he remembered later. "I had no intention of joining a ready-made party, but wanted to found one of my own. What they asked of me was presumptuous and out of the question." He was about to say so in a letter when curiosity won out, and he decided to go to a committee meeting to which he had been invited, and explain in person his reasons for not joining this absurd little organization. The tavern in which the meeting was to take place was the Alte Rosenbad in the Herrenstrasse, a very run-down place. "I went through the ill-lit dining room in which not a soul was sitting, opened the door to the back room, and there I was face to face with the committee. In the dim light of a grimy gas lamp, four young people sat at a table, among them the author of the little pamphlet, who at once greeted me most joyfully and bade me welcome as a new member of the German Workers' Party. Really, I was somewhat taken aback. The minutes of the last meeting were read and the secretary given a vote of confidence. Next came the treasury report. All in all, the association possessed 7 marks and 50 pfennigs, for which the treasurer received a vote of confidence. This, too, was entered in the minutes. Then the first chairman read the answers to a letter from Kiel, one from Düsseldorf, and one from Berlin, and everyone expressed approval. Next, a report was given on the incoming mail. Terrible, terrible! This was club life of the worst manner and sort. Was I to join this organization? Yet there was something about these shabby men in the ill-lit back room that attracted him, the longing for a new movement which should be more than a party in the previous sense of the word. That evening he returned to the barracks to face the hardest question of my life. Should I join? Reason, he admits, told him to decline. And yet, the very unimportance of the organization would give a young man of energy and ideas an opportunity for real personal activity. Hitler thought over what he could bring to this task. That I was poor and without means seemed to me the most bearable part of it. But it was harder that I was numbered among the nameless, that I was one of the millions whom chance permits to live or summons out of existence without even their closest neighbors condescending to take any notice of it. In addition, there was the difficulty which inevitably rose from my lack of schooling. After 2 days of agonized pondering and reflection, I finally came to the conviction that I had to take this step. It was the most decisive resolve of my life. From here, there was and could be no turning back. Adolf Hitler was then and there enrolled as the 7th member of the committee of the German Workers' Party. There were 2 members of this insignificant party who deserve mention at this point. Both were to prove important in the rise of Hitler. Captain Ernst Röhm, on the staff of the Army's District Command 7 in Munich, had joined the party before Hitler. He was a stocky, bull-necked, piggish-eyed, scar-faced professional soldier, the upper part of his nose had been shot away in 1914, with a flair for politics and a natural ability as an organizer. Like Hitler, he was possessed of a burning hatred for the Democratic Republic and the November criminals he held responsible for it. His aim was to recreate a strong nationalist Germany, and he believed with Hitler that this could be done only by a party based on the lower classes, from which he himself, unlike most regular army officers, had come. A tough, ruthless, driving man, albeit like so many of the early Nazis, a homosexual, he helped to organize the first Nazi strong-arm squads which grew into the SA, the army of stormtroopers which he commanded until his execution by Hitler in 1934. Röhm not only brought into the budding party large numbers of ex-servicemen and Free Corps volunteers, who formed the backbone of the organization in its early years, but as an officer of the army, which controlled Bavaria, he obtained for Hitler and his movement the protection and sometimes the support of the authorities. Without this help, Hitler probably could never have got a real start in his campaign to incite the people to overthrow the Republic. Certainly he could not have got away with his methods of terror and intimidation without the tolerance of the Bavarian government and police. Dietrich Eckart, 21 years older than Hitler, was often called the spiritual founder of National Socialism. A witty journalist, a mediocre poet and dramatist, he had translated Ibsen's Peer Gynt and written a number of unproduced plays. In Berlin, for a time, he had led, like Hitler in Vienna, the bohemian vagrant's life, become a drunkard, taken to morphine, and, according to Haydn, been confined to a mental institution where he was finally able to stage his dramas using the inmates as actors. He had returned to his native Bavaria at the war's end and held forth before a circle of admirers at the Brennessel wine cellar in Schwabling, the artist's quarter in Munich, preaching Aryan superiority and calling for the elimination of the Jews and the downfall of the swine in Berlin. "We need a fellow at the head," Haydn, who was a working newspaper man in Munich at the time, quotes Eckart as declaiming to the habitués of the Brennessel wine cellar in 1919. "Who can stand the sound of a machine gun? The rabble need to get fear into their pants. We can't use an officer because the people don't respect them anymore. The best would be a worker who knows how to talk. He doesn't need much brains. He must be a bachelor, then we'll get the women." What more natural than that the hard-drinking poet, Eckart died of overdrinking in December 1923, should find in Adolf Hitler the very man he was looking for. He became a close advisor to the rising young man in the German Workers' Party, lending him books, helping to improve his German, both written and spoken, and introducing him to his wide circle of friends, which included not only certain wealthy persons who were induced to contribute to the party's funds and Hitler's living, but such future aides as Rudolf Hess and Alfred Rosenberg. Hitler's admiration for Eckart never flagged, and the last sentence of Mein Kampf is an expression of gratitude to this erratic mentor. He was, says Hitler in concluding his book, one of the best who devoted his life to the awakening of our people, in his writings and his thoughts, and finally in his deeds. Such was the weird assortment of misfits who founded National Socialism, who unknowingly began to shape a movement which in 13 years would sweep the country, the strongest in Europe, and bring to Germany its Third Reich. The confused locksmith Drexler provided the kernel, the drunken poet Eckhart some of the spiritual foundation, the economic crank Feder what passed as an ideology, the homosexual room the support of the army and the war veterans. But it was now the former tramp, Adolf Hitler, not quite 31 and utterly unknown, who took the lead in building up what had been no more than a backroom debating society into what would soon become a formidable political party. All the ideas which had been bubbling in his mind since the lonesome days of hunger in Vienna now found an outlet, and an inner energy which had not been observable in his makeup burst forth. He prodded his timid committee into organizing bigger meetings. He personally typed out and distributed invitations. Later he recalled how once, after he had distributed 80 of these, we sat waiting for the masses who were expected to appear. An hour late, the chairman had to open the meeting. We were again 7, the old 7. But he was not to be discouraged. He increased the number of invitations by having them mimeographed. He collected a few marks to insert a notice of a meeting in a local newspaper. The success, he says, was positively amazing. 111 people were present. Hitler was to make his first public speech following the main address by a Munich professor. Harrer, nominal head of the party, objected. This gentleman, who was certainly otherwise honest, Hitler relates, just happened to be convinced that I might be capable of doing certain things, but not of speaking. I spoke for 30 minutes, and what before I had simply felt within me, without in any way knowing it, was now proved by reality. I could speak. Hitler claims the audience was electrified by his oratory, and its enthusiasm proved by donations of 300 marks, which temporarily relieved the party of its financial worries. At the start of 1920, Hitler took over the party's propaganda, an activity to which he had given much thought since he had observed its importance in the socialist and Christian social parties in Vienna. He began immediately to organize by far the biggest meeting ever dreamt of by the pitifully small party. It was to be held on February 24, 1920, in the Festsaal of the famous Hofbräuhaus, with a seating capacity of nearly 2,000. Hitler's fellow committeemen thought he was crazy. Harrer resigned in protest and was replaced by Drexler, who remained skeptical. Harrer also was opposed to Hitler's violent anti-Semitism and believed that Hitler was alienating the working-class masses. These were the real reasons why he resigned. Hitler emphasizes that he personally conducted the preparations. Indeed, the event loomed so large for him that he concludes the first volume of Mein Kampf with a description of it, because, he explains, it was the occasion when the party burst the narrow bonds of a small club and for the first time exerted a determining influence on the mightiest factor of our time, public opinion. Hitler was not even scheduled as the main speaker. This role was reserved for a certain Dr. Johannes Dingfelder, a homeopathic physician, a crackpot who contributed articles on economics to the newspapers under the pseudonym of Germanus Agricola, and who was soon to be forgotten. His speech was greeted with silence. Then Hitler began to speak. As he describes the scene, there was a hail of shouts, there were violent clashes in the hall, a handful of the most faithful war comrades and other supporters battled with the disturbers, communists and socialists, and only little by little were able to restore order. I was able to go on speaking. After half an hour, the applause slowly began to drown out the screaming and shouting. When, after nearly 4 hours, the hall began to empty, I knew that now the principles of the movement, which could no longer be forgotten, were moving out among the German people. In the course of his speech, Hitler had enunciated for the first time the 25 points of the program of the German Workers' Party. They had been hastily drawn up by Drexler, Feder, and Hitler. Most of the heckling at Hitler had really been directed against parts of the program which he read out. But he nevertheless considered all the points as having been adopted, and they became the official program of the Nazi Party when its name was altered on April 1, 1920, to the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Indeed, for tactical reasons, Hitler in 1926 declared them unalterable. They are certainly a hodgepodge, a catch-all for the workers, the lower middle class, and the peasants, and most of them were forgotten by the time the party came to power. A good many writers on Germany have ridiculed them, and the Nazi leader himself was later to be embarrassed when reminded of some of them. Yet, as in the case of the main principles laid down in Mein Kampf, the most important of them were carried out by the Third Reich, with consequences disastrous to millions of people inside and outside of Germany. The very first point in the program demanded the union of all Germans in a greater Germany. Was this not exactly what Chancellor Hitler would insist on and get when he annexed Austria and its 6 million Germans? When he took the Sudetenland with its 3 million Germans? And was it not his demand for the return of German Danzig and the other areas in Poland inhabited predominantly by Germans which led to the German attack on Poland and brought on World War II? And cannot it be added that it was one of the world's misfortunes that so many in the interwar years either ignored or laughed off the Nazi aims which Hitler had taken the pains to put down in writing? Surely the anti-Semitic points of the program promulgated in the Munich Beer Hall on the evening of February 24, 1920, constituted a dire warning. The Jews were to be denied office and even citizenship in Germany, and excluded from the press. All who had entered the Reich after August 2, 1914, were to be expelled. A good many paragraphs of the party program were obviously merely a demagogic appeal to the mood of the lower classes at a time when they were in bad straits, and were sympathetic to radical and even socialist slogans. Point 11, for example, demanded abolition of incomes unearned by work. Point 12, the nationalization of trusts. Point 13, the sharing with the state of profits from large industry. Point 14, the abolishing of land rents and speculation in land. Point 18 demanded the death penalty for traitors, usurers, and profiteers. And point 16, calling for the maintenance of a sound middle class, insisted on the communalization of department stores and their lease at cheap rates to small traders. These demands had been put in at the insistence of Drexler and Feder, who apparently really believed in the socialism of National Socialism. They were the ideas which Hitler was to find embarrassing when the big industrialists and landlords began to pour money into the party coffers, and of course nothing was ever done about them. There were finally 2 points of the program which Hitler would carry out as soon as he became chancellor. Point 2 demanded the abrogation of the treaties of Versailles and Saint-Germain. The last point, number 25, insisted on the creation of a strong central power of the state. This, like points 1 and 2, demanding the union of all Germans in the Reich and the abolition of the peace treaties, was put into the program at Hitler's insistence, and it showed how even then, when his party was hardly known outside Munich, he was casting his eyes on further horizons, even at the risk of losing popular support in his own bailiwick. Separatism was very strong in Bavaria at the time, and the Bavarians, constantly at odds with the central government in Berlin, were demanding less, not more, centralization, so that Bavaria could rule itself. In fact, this was what it was doing at the moment. Berlin's writ had very little authority in the states. Hitler was looking ahead for power not only in Bavaria, but eventually in the Reich, and to hold and exercise that power, a dictatorial regime such as he had already envisaged needed to constitute itself as a strong, centralized authority, doing away with the semi-autonomous states which under the Weimar Republic, as under the Hohenzollern Empire, enjoyed their own parliaments and governments. One of his first acts after January 30, 1933, was to swiftly carry out this final point in the party's program, which so few had noticed or taken seriously. No one could say he had not given ample warning in writing from the very beginning. Inflammatory oratory and a radical catch-all program, important as they were for a fledgling party out to attract attention and recruit mass support, were not enough. And Hitler now turned his attention to providing more, much more. The first signs of his peculiar genius began to appear and make themselves felt. What the masses needed, he thought, were not only ideas, a few simple ideas, that is, that he could ceaselessly hammer through their skulls, but symbols that would win their faith, pageantry and color that would arouse them, and acts of violence and terror which, if successful, would attract adherents. Were not most Germans drawn to the strong, and give them a sense of power over the weak? In Vienna, as we have seen, he was intrigued by what he called the infamous spiritual and physical terror, which he thought was employed by the Social Democrats against their political opponents. Now he turned it to good purpose in his own anti-socialist party. At first, ex-servicemen were assigned to the meetings to silence hecklers and, if necessary, toss them out. In the summer of 1920, soon after the party had added National Socialist to the name of the German Workers' Party and became the National Socialist German Workers' Party, or NSDAP, as it was now to be familiarly known, Hitler organized a bunch of roughneck war veterans into strong-arm squads, Ordnertruppe, under the command of Emil Moritz, an ex-convict and watchmaker. On October 5, 1921, after camouflaging themselves for a short time as the Gymnastic and Sports Division of the party to escape suppression by the Berlin government, they were officially named the Sturmabteilung, from which the name SA came. The stormtroopers, outfitted in brown uniforms, were recruited largely from the freebooters of the Free Corps and placed under the command of Johann Ulrich Klintzik, an aide of the notorious Captain Erhard, who had recently been released from imprisonment in connection with the murder of Erzberger. These uniformed rowdies, not content to keep order at Nazi meetings, soon took to breaking up those of the other parties. Once, in 1921, Hitler personally led his stormtroopers in an attack on a meeting which was to be addressed by a Bavarian Federalist by the name of Ballerstedt, who received a beating. For this, Hitler was sentenced to 3 months in jail, one of which he served. This was his first experience in jail, and he emerged from it somewhat of a martyr and more popular than ever. "It's all right," Hitler boasted to the police. "We got what we wanted. Ballerstedt did not speak." As Hitler had told an audience some months before, "The National Socialist movement will in the future ruthlessly prevent, if necessary by force, all meetings or lectures that are likely to distract the minds of our fellow countrymen." In the summer of 1920, Hitler, the frustrated artist but now becoming the master propagandist, came up with an inspiration which can only be described as a stroke of genius. What the party lacked, he saw, was an emblem, a flag, a symbol, which would express what the new organization stood for and appeal to the imagination of the masses, who, as Hitler reasoned, must have some striking banner to follow and to fight under. After much thought and innumerable attempts at various designs, he hit upon a flag with a red background, and in the middle a white disc on which was imprinted a black swastika. The hooked cross, the Hakenkreuz, of the swastika, borrowed though it was from more ancient times, was to become a mighty and frightening symbol of the Nazi Party, and ultimately of Nazi Germany. Whence Hitler got the idea of using it for both the flag and the insignia of the party, he does not say in a lengthy dissertation on the subject in Mein Kampf. The Hakenkreuz is as old, almost as man, on the planet. It has been found in the ruins of Troy, and of Egypt, and China. I myself have seen it in ancient Hindu and Buddhist relics in India. In more recent times, it showed up as an official emblem in such Baltic states as Estonia and Finland, where the men of the German Free Corps saw it during the fighting of 1918 to 1919. The Erhard Brigade had it painted on their steel helmets when they entered Berlin during the Kapp Putsch in 1920. Hitler had undoubtedly seen it in Austria in the emblems of one or the other anti-Semitic parties, and perhaps he was struck by it when the Erhard Brigade came to Munich. He says that numerous designs suggested to him by party members invariably included a swastika, and that a dentist from Sternberg actually delivered a design for a flag that was not bad at all and quite close to my own. For the colors, Hitler had of course rejected the black, red, and gold of the hated Weimar Republic. He declined to adopt the old imperial flag of red, white, and black, but he liked its colors not only because, he says, they form the most brilliant harmony in existence, but because they were the colors of a Germany for which he had fought. But they had to be given a new form, and so a swastika was added. Hitler reveled in his unique creation. "A symbol it really is," he exclaims in Mein Kampf. "In red, we see the social idea of the movement. In white, the nationalist idea. In the swastika, the mission of the struggle for the victory of the Aryan man." Soon the swastika armband was devised for the uniforms of the stormtroopers and the party members, and 2 years later Hitler designed the Nazi standards, which would be carried in the massive parades and would adorn the stages of the mass meetings. Taken from old Roman designs, they consisted of a black metal swastika on top, with a silver wreath surmounted by an eagle, and below the initials NSDAP on a metal rectangle from which hung cords with fringe and tassels, a square swastika flag with Deutschland erwache, Germany awake, emblazoned on it. This may not have been art, but it was propaganda of the highest order. The Nazis now had a symbol which no other party could match. The hooked cross seemed to possess some mystic power of its own, to beckon to action in a new direction the insecure lower middle classes which had been floundering in the uncertainty of the first chaotic post-war years. They began to flock under its banner. Advent of the Führer. In the summer of 1921, the rising young agitator who had shown such surprising talents, not only as an orator, but as an organizer and a propagandist, took over the undisputed leadership of the party. In doing so, he gave his fellow workers a first taste of the ruthlessness and tactical shrewdness with which he was to gain so much success in more important crises later on. Early in the summer, Hitler had gone to Berlin to get in touch with North German nationalist elements and to speak at the National Club, which was their spiritual headquarters. He wanted to assess the possibilities of carrying his own movement beyond the Bavarian borders into the rest of Germany. Perhaps he could make some useful alliances for that purpose. While he was away, the other members of the committee of the Nazi Party decided the moment was opportune to challenge his leadership. He had become too dictatorial for them. They proposed some alliances themselves with similarly minded groups in South Germany, especially with the German Socialist Party, which a notorious Jew-baiter, Julius Streicher, a bitter enemy and a rival of Hitler, was building up in Nuremberg. The committee members were sure that if these groups, with their ambitious leaders, could be merged with the Nazis, Hitler would be reduced in size. Sensing the threat to his position, Hitler hurried back to Munich to quell the intrigues of these foolish lunatics, as he called them in Mein Kampf. He offered to resign from the party. This was more than the party could afford, as the other members of the committee quickly realized. Hitler was not only their most powerful speaker, but their best organizer and propagandist. Moreover, it was he who was now bringing in most of the organization's funds, from collections at the mass meetings at which he spoke, and from other sources as well, including the army. If he left, the budding Nazi party would surely go to pieces. The committee refused to accept his resignation. Hitler, reassured of the strength of his position, now forced a complete capitulation on the other leaders. He demanded dictatorial powers for himself as the party's sole leader, the abolition of the committee itself, and an end to intrigues with other groups, such as Streicher's. This was too much for the other committee members. Led by the party's founder, Anton Drexler, they drew up an indictment of the would-be dictator and circulated it as a pamphlet. It was the most drastic accusation Hitler was ever confronted with from the ranks of his own party, from those, that is, who had first-hand knowledge of his character and how he operated. "A lust for power and personal ambition have caused Herr Adolf Hitler to return to his post after his 6 weeks' stay in Berlin, of which the purpose has not yet been disclosed. He regards the time as ripe for bringing disunion and schism into our ranks, by means of shadowy people behind him, and thus to further the interests of the Jews and their friends. It grows more and more clear that his purpose is simply to use the National Socialist Party as a springboard for his own immoral purposes, and to seize the leadership in order to force the party onto a different track at the psychological moment. This is most clearly shown by an ultimatum which he sent to the party leaders a few days ago, in which he demands, among other things, that he shall have a sole and absolute dictatorship of the party, and that the committee, including the locksmith Anton Drexler, the founder and leader of the party, should retire. And how does he carry on his campaign? Like a Jew. He twists every fact. National Socialists, make up your minds about such characters. Make no mistake, Hitler is a demagogue. He believes himself capable of filling you up with all kinds of tales that are anything but the truth. Although weakened by a silly anti-Semitism, Hitler acting like a Jew, the charges were substantially true, but publicizing them did not get the rebels as far as might be supposed. Hitler promptly brought a libel suit against the authors of the pamphlet, and Drexler himself, at a public meeting, was forced to repudiate it. In two special meetings of the party, Hitler dictated his peace terms. The statutes were changed to abolish the committee and give him dictatorial powers as president. The humiliated Drexler was booted upstairs as honorary president, and he soon passed out of the picture. He left the party in 1923, but served as vice president of the Bavarian Diet from 1924 to 1928. In 1930, he became reconciled with Hitler, but he never returned to active politics. The fate of all discoverers, as Haydn observed, overtook Drexler. As Haydn says, it was the victory of the Cavaliers over the Roundheads of the party. But it was more than that. Then and there, in July 1921, was established the leadership principle, which was to be the law first of the Nazi Party and then of the Third Reich. The Führer had arrived on the German scene. The leader now set to work to reorganize the party. The gloomy taproom in the back of the Sternecker Breu, which to Hitler was more of a funeral vault than an office, was given up and new offices in another tavern in the Corneliusstrasse occupied. These were lighter and roomier. An old Adler typewriter was purchased on the installment plan, and a safe, filing cabinets, furniture, a telephone, and a full-time paid secretary were gradually acquired. Money was beginning to come in. Nearly a year before, in December of 1920, the party had acquired a run-down newspaper badly in debt, the Fürkischer Beobachter, an anti-Semitic gossip sheet which appeared twice a week. Exactly where the 60,000 marks for its purchase came from was a secret which Hitler kept well, but it is known that Eckart and Röhm persuaded Major General Ritter von Epp, Röhm's commanding officer in the Reichswehr, and himself a member of the party, to raise the sum. Most likely it came from army secret funds. At the beginning of 1923, the Fürkischer Beobachter became a daily, thus giving Hitler the prerequisite of all German political parties, a daily newspaper in which to preach the party's gospels. Running a daily political journal required additional money, and this now came from what must have seemed to some of the more proletarian roughnecks of the party like strange sources. Frau Helena Beckstein, wife of the wealthy piano manufacturer, was one. From their first meeting, she took a liking to the young firebrand, inviting him to stay at the Beckstein home when he was in Berlin, arranging parties in which he could meet the affluent, and donating sizable sums to the movement. Part of the money to finance the new daily came from a Frau Gertrud von Seidlitz, a Balt, who owned stock in some prosperous Finnish paper mills. In March 1923, a Harvard graduate, Ernst Putzi Hampstengel, whose mother was American and whose cultivated and wealthy family owned an art publishing business in Munich, loaned the party $1,000 against a mortgage on the Fürkischer Beobachter. This was a fabulous sum in marks in those inflationary days and was of immense help to the party and its newspaper. But the friendship of the Hampstengels extended beyond monetary help. It was one of the first respectable families of means in Munich to open its doors to the brawling young politician. Putzi became a good friend of Hitler, who eventually made him chief of the foreign press department of the party. An eccentric gangling man, whose sardonic wit somewhat compensated for his shallow mind, Hampstengel was a virtuoso at the piano, and on many an evening, even after his friend came to power in Berlin, he would excuse himself from the company of those of us who might be with him to answer a hasty summons from the Führer. It was said that his piano playing, he pounded the instrument furiously, and his clowning soothed Hitler and even cheered him up after a tiring day. Later, this strange but genial Harvard man, like some other early cronies of Hitler, would have to flee the country for his life. In his memoirs, Unheard Witness, Hans Stengel says that he was first steered to Hitler by an American. This was Captain Truman Smith, then an assistant military attaché at the American Embassy in Berlin. In November 1922, Smith was sent by the embassy to Munich to check on an obscure political agitator by the name of Adolf Hitler and his newly founded National Socialist Labor Party. For a young professional American Army officer, Captain Smith had a remarkable bent for political analysis. In 1 week in Munich, November 15th to 22nd, he managed to see Ludendorff, Crown Prince Ruprecht, and a dozen political leaders in Bavaria, most of whom told him that Hitler was a rising star and his movement a rapidly growing political force. Smith lost no time in attending an outdoor Nazi rally at which Hitler spoke. "Never saw such a sight in my life," he scribbled in his diary immediately afterward. "Met Hitler," he wrote, "and he promises to talk to me Monday and explain his aims." On the Monday, Smith made his way to Hitler's residence, a little bare bedroom on the second floor of a run-down house, as he described it, and had a long talk with the future dictator, who was scarcely known outside Munich. "A marvelous demagogue," the assistant U.S. military attaché began his diary that evening. "Have rarely listened to such a logical and fanatical man." The date was November 22, 1922. Just before leaving for Berlin that evening, Smith saw Hans Stengel, told him of his meeting with Hitler, and advised him to take a look at the man. The Nazi leader was to address a rally that evening, and Captain Smith turned over his press ticket to Hans Stengel. The latter, like so many others, was overwhelmed by Hitler's oratory, sought him out after the meeting, and quickly became a convert to Nazism. Back in Berlin, which at that time took little notice of Hitler, Captain Smith wrote a lengthy report which the embassy dispatched to Washington on November 25, 1922. Considering when it was written, it is a remarkable document. "The most active political force in Bavaria at the present time," Smith wrote, "is the National Socialist Labor Party. Less a political party than a popular movement, it must be considered as the Bavarian counterpart to the Italian Fascisti. It has recently acquired a political influence quite disproportionate to its actual numerical strength. Adolf Hitler from the very first has been the dominating force in the movement, and the personality of this man has undoubtedly been one of the most important factors contributing to its success. His ability to influence a popular assembly is uncanny. In private conversation, he disclosed himself as a forceful and logical speaker, which, when tempered with a fanatical earnestness, made a very deep impression on a neutral listener." Colonel Smith, who later served as American military attaché in Berlin during the early years of the Nazi regime, kindly placed his diary and notes of his trip to Munich at the disposal of this writer. They have been invaluable in the preparation of this chapter. Hans Stengel spent part of World War II in Washington, ostensibly as an interned enemy alien, but actually as an advisor to the United States government on Nazi Germany. This final role of his life, which seemed so ludicrous to Americans who knew him and Nazi Germany, must have amused him. Most of the men who were to become Hitler's closest subordinates were now in the party or would shortly enter it. Rudolf Hess joined in 1920. Son of a German wholesale merchant domiciled in Egypt, Hess had spent the first 14 years of his life in that country and then come to the Rhineland for his education. During the war, he served for a time in the List Regiment with Hitler, though they did not become acquainted then, and after being twice wounded, became a flyer. He enrolled in the University of Munich after the war as a student of economics, but seems to have spent much of his time distributing anti-Semitic pamphlets and fighting with the various armed bands then at loose in Bavaria. He was in the thick of the firing when the Soviet regime in Munich was overthrown on May 1, 1919, and was wounded in the leg. One evening a year later, he went to hear Hitler speak, was carried away by his eloquence, and joined the party, and soon he became a close friend, a devoted follower, and secretary of the leader. It was he who introduced Hitler to the geopolitical ideas of General Karl Haushofer, then a professor of geopolitics at the university. Hess had stirred Hitler with a prize-winning essay which he wrote for a thesis entitled, "How Must the Man Be Constituted Who Will Lead Germany Back to Her Old Heights?" Where all authority has vanished, only a man of the people can establish authority. The deeper the dictator was originally rooted in the broad masses, the better he understands how to treat them psychologically, the less the workers will distrust him, the more supporters he will win among these most energetic ranks of the people. He himself has nothing in common with the mass. Like every great man, he is all personality. When necessity commands, he does not shrink before bloodshed. Great questions are always decided by blood and iron. In order to reach his goal, he is prepared to trample on his closest friends. The lawgiver proceeds with terrible hardness. As the need arises, he can trample them, the people, with the boots of a grenadier. No wonder Hitler took to the young man. This was a portrait, perhaps not of the leader as he was at the moment, but of the leader he wanted to become, and did. For all his solemnity and studiousness, Hess remained a man of limited intelligence, always receptive to crackpot ideas, which he could adopt with great fanaticism. Until nearly the end, he would be one of Hitler's most loyal and trusted followers and one of the few who was not bitten by consuming personal ambition. Alfred Rosenberg, though he was often hailed as the intellectual leader of the Nazi Party, and indeed its philosopher, was also a man of mediocre intelligence. Rosenberg may with some truth be put down as a Russian. Like a good many Russian intellectuals, he was of Baltic German stock. The son of a shoemaker, he was born January 12, 1893, at Reval, now Tallinn, in Estonia, which had been a part of the Tsarist Empire since 1721. He chose to study not in Germany but in Russia and received a diploma in architecture from the University of Moscow in 1917. He lived in Moscow through the days of the Bolshevik Revolution, and it may be that, as some of his enemies in the Nazi Party later said, he flirted with the idea of becoming a young Bolshevik revolutionary. In February 1918, however, he returned to Reval, volunteered for service in the German army when it reached the city, was turned down as a Russian, and finally, at the end of 1918, made his way to Munich, where he first became active in White Russian émigré circles. Rosenberg then met Dietrich Eckart and, through him, Hitler, and joined the party at the end of 1919. It was inevitable that a man who had actually received a diploma in architecture would impress the man who had failed even to get into a school of architecture. Hitler was also impressed by Rosenberg's learning, and he liked the young Balt's hatred of the Jews and the Bolsheviks. Shortly before Eckart died, toward the end of 1923, Hitler made Rosenberg editor of the Völkischer Beobachter, and for many years he continued to prop up this utterly muddled man, this confused and shallow philosopher, as the intellectual mentor of the Nazi movement and as one of its chief authorities on foreign policy. Like Rudolf Hess, Hermann Göring had also come to Munich sometime after the war, ostensibly to study economics at the university, and he too had come under the personal spell of Adolf Hitler. One of the nation's great war heroes, the last commander of the famed Richthofen fighter squadron, holder of the Pour le Mérite, the highest war decoration in Germany, he found it even more difficult than most war veterans to return to the humdrum existence of peacetime civilian life. He became a transport pilot in Denmark for a time, and later in Sweden. One day he flew Count Erich von Rosen to the latter's estate some distance from Stockholm, and while stopping over as a guest fell in love with Countess Rosen's sister, Karin von Kantzow, nay Baroness Fock, one of Sweden's beauties. Some difficulties arose. Karin von Kantzow was epileptic and was married and the mother of an 8-year-old son. But she was able to have the marriage dissolved and marry the gallant young flyer. Possessed of considerable means, she went with her new husband to Munich, where they lived in some splendor, and he dabbled in studies at the university. But not for long. He met Hitler in 1921, joined the party, contributed generously to its treasury, and to Hitler personally, threw his restless energy into helping Röhm organize the stormtroopers, and a year later in 1922, was made commander of the SA. A swarm of lesser-known and for the most part more unsavory individuals joined the circle around the party dictator. Max Amann, Hitler's first sergeant in the List regiment, a tough, uncouth character but an able organizer, was named business manager of the party and the Völkischer Beobachter, and quickly brought order into the finances of both. As his personal bodyguard, Hitler chose Ulrich Graf, an amateur wrestler, a butcher's apprentice, and a renowned brawler. As his court photographer, the only man who for years was permitted to photograph him, Hitler had the lame Heinrich Hofmann, whose loyalty was dog-like and profitable, making him in the end a millionaire. Another favorite brawler was Christian Weber, a horse dealer, a former bouncer in a Munich dive, and a lusty beer drinker. Close to Hitler in these days was Hermann Esser, whose oratory rivaled the leader's and whose Jew-baiting articles in the Völkischer Beobachter were a leading feature of the party newspaper. He made no secret that for a time he lived well off the generosity of some of his mistresses. A notorious blackmailer, resorting to threats to expose even his own party comrades who crossed him, Esser became so repulsive to some of the older and more decent men in the movement that they demanded his expulsion. "I know Esser as a scoundrel," Hitler retorted in public, "but I shall hold on to him as long as he can be of use to me." This was to be his attitude toward almost all of his close collaborators, no matter how murky their past, or indeed their present. Murderers, pimps, homosexual perverts, drug addicts, or just plain rowdies were all the same to him if they served his purposes. He stood Julius Streicher, for example, almost to the end. This depraved sadist, who started life as an elementary school teacher, was one of the most disreputable men around Hitler from 1922 until 1939, when his star finally faded. A famous fornicator, as he boasted, who blackmailed even the husbands of women who were his mistresses, he made his fame and fortune as a blindly fanatical anti-Semite. His notorious weekly, Der Stürmer, thrived on lurid tales of Jewish sexual crimes and Jewish ritual murders. Its obscenity was nauseating, even to many Nazis. Streicher was also a noted pornographist. He became known as the uncrowned king of Franconia, with the center of his power in Nuremberg, where his word was law and where no one who crossed him or displeased him was safe from prison and torture. "Until I faced him slumped in the dock at Nuremberg, on trial for his life as a war criminal, I never saw him without a whip in his hand or in his belt, and he laughingly boasted of the countless lashings he had meted out." Such were the men whom Hitler gathered around him in the early years for his drive to become dictator of a nation which had given the world a Luther, a Kant, a Goethe, and a Schiller, a Bach, a Beethoven, and a Brahms. On April 1, 1920, the day the German Workers' Party became the National Socialist German Workers' Party, from which the abbreviated name Nazi emerged, Hitler left the army for good. Henceforth, he would devote all of his time to the Nazi Party, from which neither then nor later did he accept any salary. How then, it might be asked, did Hitler live? His fellow party workers themselves sometimes wondered. In the indictment which the rebel members of the party committee drew up in July 1921, the question was bluntly posed. If any member asks him how he lives and what was his former profession, he always becomes angry and excited. Up to now, no answer has been supplied to these questions. So his conscience cannot be clean, especially as his excessive intercourse with ladies, to whom he often describes himself as King of Munich, costs a great deal of money. Hitler answered the question during the subsequent libel action which he brought against the authors of the pamphlet. To the question of the court as to exactly how he lived, he replied, "If I speak for the National Socialist Party, I take no money for myself. But I also speak for other organizations, and then, of course, I accept a fee. I also have my midday meal with various party comrades in turn. I am further assisted to a modest extent by a few party comrades." Probably this was very close to the truth. Such well-heeled friends as Dietrich Eckart, Goering, and Hans Stengel undoubtedly lent him money to pay his rent, purchase clothes, and buy a meal. His wants were certainly modest. Until 1929, he occupied a two-room flat in a lower-middle-class district in the Tierschstrasse near the River Isar. In the winter, he wore an old trench coat. It later became familiar to everyone in Germany from numerous photographs. In the summer, he often appeared in shorts, the lederhosen which most Bavarians donned in seasonable weather. In 1923, Eckhart and Esser stumbled upon the Platterhof, an inn near Berchtesgaden, as a summer retreat for Hitler and his friends. Hitler fell in love with the lovely mountain country. It was here that he later built the spacious villa, Berghof, which would be his home and where he would spend much of his time until the war years. There was, however, little time for rest and recreation in the stormy years between 1921 and 1923. There was a party to build and to keep control of in the face of jealous rivals as unscrupulous as himself. The NSDAP was but one of several right-wing movements in Bavaria, struggling for public attention and support, and beyond, in the rest of Germany, there were many others. There was a dizzy succession of events and of constantly changing situations for a politician to watch, to evaluate, and to take advantage of. In April 1921, the Allies had presented Germany the bill for reparations, a whopping 132 billion gold marks, $33 billion, which the Germans howled they could not possibly pay. The mark, normally valued at 4 to the dollar, had begun to fall. By the summer of 1921, it had dropped to 75, a year later to 400 to the dollar. Erzberger had been murdered in August 1921. In June 1922, there was an attempt to assassinate Philipp Scheidemann, the socialist who had proclaimed the Republic. The same month, June 24th, Foreign Minister Rathenau was shot dead in the street. In all three cases, the assassins had been men of the extreme right. The shaky national government in Berlin finally answered the challenge with a special law for the protection of the Republic, which imposed severe penalties for political terrorism. Berlin demanded the dissolution of the innumerable armed leagues and the end of political gangsterism. The Bavarian government, even under the moderate Count Lerchenfeld, who had replaced the extremist Kahr in 1921, was finding it difficult to go along with the national regime in Berlin. When it attempted to enforce the law against terrorism, the Bavarian rightists, of whom Hitler was now one of the acknowledged young leaders, organized a conspiracy to overthrow Lerchenfeld and march on Berlin to bring down the Republic. The fledgling democratic Weimar Republic was in deep trouble, its very existence constantly threatened not only from the extreme right, but from the extreme left. Chapter 3. Versailles, Weimar, and the Bierhall Putsch. To most men in the victorious Allied lands of the West, the proclamation of the Republic in Berlin on November 9, 1918, it appeared to mark the dawn of a new day for the German people and their nation. Woodrow Wilson, in the exchange of notes which led to the armistice, had pressed for the abolition of the Hohenzollern militarist autocracy, and the Germans had seemingly obliged him, although reluctantly. The Kaiser had been forced to abdicate and to flee. The monarchy was dissolved. All the dynasties in Germany were quickly done away with, and republican government was proclaimed. But proclaimed by accident. On the afternoon of November 9th, the so-called majority social democrats under the leadership of Friedrich Ebert and Philipp Scheidemann met in the Reichstag in Berlin following the resignation of the Chancellor, Prince Max of Baden. They were sorely puzzled as to what to do. Prince Max had just announced the abdication of the Kaiser. Ebert, a saddler by trade, thought that one of Wilhelm's sons, anyone except a dissolute crown prince, might succeed him, for he favored a constitutional monarchy on the British pattern. Ebert, though he led the socialists, abhorred social revolution. "I hate it like sin," he had once declared. But revolution was in the air in Berlin. The capital was paralyzed by a general strike. Down the broad Unter den Linden, a few blocks from the Reichstag, the Spartacists, led by the left socialists Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, were preparing from their citadel in the Kaiser's palace to proclaim a Soviet republic. When word of this reached the socialists in the Reichstag, they were consternated. Something had to be done at once to forestall the Spartacists. Scheidemann thought of something. Without consulting his comrades, he dashed to the window overlooking the Königsplatz, where a great throng had gathered, stuck his head out, and on his own, as if the idea had just popped into his head, proclaimed the Republic. The saddlemaker Ebert was furious. He had hoped somehow to save the Hohenzollern monarchy. Thus was the German Republic born, as if by a fluke. If the socialists themselves were not staunch Republicans, it could hardly be expected that the conservatives would be. But the latter had abdicated their responsibility. They and the army leaders, Ludendorff and Hindenburg, had pushed political power into the hands of the reluctant Social Democrats. In doing so, they managed also to place on the shoulders of these democratic working-class leaders apparent responsibility for signing the surrender and ultimately the peace treaty, thus laying on them the blame for Germany's defeat and for whatever suffering a lost war and a dictated peace might bring upon the German people. This was a shabby trick, one which the merest child would be expected to see through, but in Germany it worked. It doomed the Republic from the start. Perhaps it need not have. In November 1918, the Social Democrats, holding absolute power, might have quickly laid the foundation for a lasting democratic republic. But to have done so, they would have had to suppress permanently, or at least curb permanently, the forces which had propped up the Hohenzollern Empire, and which would not loyally accept a democratic Germany, the feudal Junker landlords and other upper castes, the magnates who ruled over the great industrial cartels, the roving condottieri of the Free Corps, the ranking officials of the Imperial Civil Service, and, above all, the military caste and the members of the General Staff. They would have had to break up many of the great estates, which were wasteful and uneconomic, and the industrial monopolies and cartels, and clean out the bureaucracy, the judiciary, the police, the universities, and the army of all who would not loyally and honestly serve the new democratic regime. This, the Social Democrats, who were mostly well-meaning trade unionists with the same habit of bowing to old established authority which was ingrained in Germans of other classes, could not bring themselves to do. Instead, they began by abdicating their authority to the force which had always been dominant in modern Germany, the army. For though it had been defeated on the battlefield, the army still had hopes of maintaining itself at home and of defeating the revolution. To achieve these ends, it moved swiftly and boldly. On the night of November 9, 1918, a few hours after the Republic had been proclaimed, a telephone rang in the study of Ebert in the Reich Chancellery in Berlin. It was a very special telephone, for it was linked with Supreme Headquarters at Spa by a private and secret line. Ebert was alone. He picked up the telephone. "Gruner speaking," a voice said. The former saddle-maker, still bewildered by the day's events which had suddenly thrust into his unwilling hands whatever political power remained in a crumbling Germany, was impressed. General Wilhelm Gruner was the successor of Ludendorff as first quartermaster general. Earlier on that very day at Spa, it was he who, when Field Marshal von Hindenburg faltered, had bluntly informed the Kaiser that he no longer commanded the loyalty of his troops and must go. A brave act for which the military caste never forgave him. Ebert and Gruner had developed a bond of mutual respect since 1916, when the general, then in charge of war production, had worked closely with the socialist leader. Early in November, a few days before, they had conferred in Berlin on how to save the monarchy and the fatherland. Now, at the fatherland's lowest moment, a secret telephone line brought them together. Then and there the socialist leader and the second in command of the German army made a pact which, though it would not be publicly known for many years, was to determine the nation's fate. Ebert agreed to put down anarchy and Bolshevism and maintain the army in all its tradition. Gruner thereupon pledged the support of the army in helping the new government establish itself and carry out its aims. "Will the field marshal, Hindenburg, retain the command?" Ebert asked. General Gruner replied that he would. "Convey to the field marshal the thanks of the government," Ebert replied. The German army was saved, but the Republic, on the very day of its birth, was lost. The generals, with the honorable exception of Gruner himself and but few others, would never serve it loyally. In the end, led by Hindenburg, they betrayed it to the Nazis. At the moment, to be sure, the specter of what had just happened in Russia haunted the minds of Ebert and his fellow socialists. They did not want to become the German Kerenskys. They did not want to be supplanted by the Bolshevists. Everywhere in Germany, the soldiers and workers' councils were springing up and assuming power, as they had done in Russia. It was these groups which on November 10th elected a Council of People's Representatives, with Ebert at its head, to govern Germany for the time being. In December, the First Soviet Congress of Germany met in Berlin. Composed of delegates from the soldiers' and workers' councils throughout the country, it demanded the dismissal of Hindenburg, the abolition of the regular army, and the substitution of a civil guard, whose officers would be elected by the men and which would be under the supreme authority of the council. This was